Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Everyone knows the animal protein market has to be disruptive massively, and maybe most of all the beef market. Take, for instance, Italy, where 85% of beef comes from factory farmed, which means inside with a lot of inputs and horrible animal welfare practices, plus, of course, the negative health outcomes for who consumes that meat. Plus, 50% of the total beef consumption is actually imported, many cases from questionable markets. Saying this should change is easy, but how do you actually do that? How do you build a supply chain or web from the ground up? B2C versus B2B, and how do you work with the large supermarket chains to get your products in front of more people? This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today we go deep into the beef market in Italy and how to move it from CAFO factory farmed to outside on the Alpine meadows, as you imagine in these beautiful commercials. I have the very great pleasure to have the founder of Pascal today with me. Welcome, Federico.
Hi, Kun. Thank you for inviting me.
And to ask the personal question we always like to ask at the beginning, how did you end up? I mean, I don't think you were raised as a shepherd and saw the decline of the shepherds going with their cows into the Alpine meadows and moving up and down. I think you were raised in a medium-sized city. So how did your interest in the meat market, the beef market, factory farming, and at the end, because we're going to talk about that for sure, soil, how did that start? And how did you, because you're relatively young, the viewers cannot see that, but we put a picture. Like, how did you roll into disrupting the beef market in Italy?
I studied economics, so another kind of field, but with a lot of connection with the food industry, because, you know, everything is about money and economics. So I think that's the starting point. And to be honest, I made this choice for a selfish purpose, probably, because I don't have the presumption to change the world. And I simply try to make the best possible food choice and to give as many people as possible the freedom to make the same choice. And so, you know, for a selfish purpose, as I said, I needed to eat good food in general, not just meat, but also vegetables and so on. And, you know, I think that the food chains in general nowadays have a very bad impact on both the social and environmental dimension. And in the specific, the meat industry has a very, very bad impact. And we are trying to build a different supply chain about beef in Italy.
That's it. It's a nice answer, but I want to unpack it a bit more You live in the north of Italy, relatively close to the Alps. You probably would have had access yourself if you searched a bit to this kind of meat. But it's quite a step to go from, with friends buying a cow and make sure it's slaughtered properly, make sure it was raised properly, and then putting your freezer full and be fine for a year. Going from that to processing many other cows and supplying it to others. I mean, it's a nice notion to say, I would like others to have that same option. But that means dedicating your work life to that, basically, and probably more in the startup phase. So when did that click came from, I want to have access to this, but others don't. I see an opportunity here, and I want to start a company and not just a like an organization to promote this kind of food choices. What made you choose to basically dedicate your work life to this as well?
To be honest, I love to do startup in general, to do new things that are not already done before. And, you know, we focus on meat so far, but it's not my life reason. You know, I'll try to change this sector now, but probably I'll do something else in the future. You know, the important things for me, it's just giving a good impact to the world, and about food or other industries, not that point. So I think, you know, it's a sense of ethic probably that guide my steps.
And so let's describe Pasco, as I think in Italy it didn't exist something like that. You have, I would say, similar or let's say colleagues in other countries, like special meat boxes, the Ethical Butcher in the UK and some other places. Yeah. And did you look around in Italy and thought, oh, there's nobody is like supplying ethically sourced small producers, obviously proper grazing management, and we're going to talk about that, to the supplier, and said, okay, let's set up Pasco. If you have to describe now, because you are obviously you're fundraising, you're presenting it a lot, like how do you describe Pasco in a few or a few more sentences?
We started from an objective problem. Around the 85% of meat we consume in Italy comes from intensive kind of breeding, and around the 50% of the entire cake, you know, comes from abroad. So the supply chain is
broken.
Unsustainable. Yeah, it's broken, both for the methodologies and also for the logistics.
So just to recap, 85%, which is, I think, in Europe more or less the same, even a bit higher, I think, in many places, comes from factory farmed cows that never seen the light of day, that are fed on imported feed in many cases, and we all know the destruction that comes from that. Plus, the animal welfare is horrendous. I mean, you shouldn't feed soy to a ruminant ever. And then on top of that, you're mentioning 50% of the total market actually is imported, which comes from many, many different places. Some places better, many places worse than what you find close to you. So there's a broken market there waiting to be disrupted. And how do you approach that?
So we select small farms who breed cows, cattle extensively. So basically they bring cows to the pasture and they ensure high level of animal welfare and basically life accordingly to biological needs. You know,
following cows, first principles, basically.
And, it's pretty easy. You just have to observe nature and just copy and paste. Everything is written there. You don't have to invent anything new. And what we are doing, it's cool about traceability also, because on any piece of meat, you can say which is the exactly farms where that meat comes from. So we have a innovative traceability system. And so we have like a livestock team who select the breeders and support them also with free consultancy and so on. And we are also developing, you know, side project. For instance, we are talking with No Fence for the
friends of the podcast. I will link them below. Virtual fencing, if you want to know more. Very innovative, and of course for alpine meadows, potentially disrupting and interesting. You can do interesting things. Yeah.
So first of all, we select breeders who are already integrated with the territory, with the environment, and we try to improve further their farm. Then we buy cows. The slaughter is very close to the farm. We have selected breeders in six regions in Italy, in the northern and central part of the country. And we have many slaughterhouses, you know, in any region in order to make that process very, very short.
Is that is that an issue? Because we had a full interview with Dan Miller, which I will link below as well, on slaughter facilities in the US, where cows have to travel 7, 8, 10 hours to get to a slaughter facility. And in many cases, it's a huge industrial one and they don't do the cuts you want, or they don't have space. Like, is that in Italy, is that not an issue? Can you find slaughterhouses that work well, of course, but that are nearby these farms, or is that becoming challenging also in Italy?
No, we have them because we have also a regulation approved by the ministry, and also these slaughterhouses enter into this regulation. So,
but they're still there. The slaughterhouses are still there. That infrastructure luckily didn't disappear yet. Okay, that's fundamental. So you have them slaughtered nearby, and then what happens?
And then we transport the meat to a central plant, basically in Brescia, in Lombardy, and then we process the meat in different cuts, and we distribute it. We started in 2019 on B2C channels, so the e-commerce basically, and then we approach also the B2B channels because our value proposition, it's not about the distribution of the product, but about the product itself. So we don't care a lot where the product goes. The only important thing is that with the product, it's also vehiculated the message, the vision, because we want to make customer the freedom to make a choice different in order to, with their money, adding value to the system. Because we think that, the biggest way in order to change things, it's consciousness in consumption.
Yeah, so you start, there's so much to unpack there. You start, I'm assuming you obviously pay more to the farmers than they would, and I would love to explore more also why they're not doing this themselves, like what's holding them back. And then there's a very interesting piece we're going to get to, which is B2C, so direct to consumers online, which obviously everybody, then you could keep all the margins, etc. I think many people underestimate how expensive it is to get things in a fresh way to people's house. And then you started talking to the big supermarkets, you're actually selling through them. And you said, we don't really care if they do the distribution as long as the message gets there, meaning it has to be in a Pascal way presented. It cannot go into some kind of commodity market and then be white labeled. Is that an issue actually? Let's start with the question of I'm imagining you're trying to sell the whole animal. Like the fact that you're doing obviously B2C, you can steer that. Like you can have the boxes, you can have pieces together. Then moving to B2B, like, is that an issue? Like, do you get left over with certain pieces more than another? Or is the deal with a big supermarket, look, you have to take everything and that's the deal because, we're slaughtering animals, not pieces of animal?
Yeah, this is a very difficult thing, because we, as you said, we buy just entire animals. And so, I think the secret in order to sell everything in a good way is having a lot of clients in different sector. For instance, butchers, of course, large distribution stores, and also, for instance, burgers stores. So you have to have a lot of clients in order to vehiculate any cuts without problem. And of course, at the beginning of these, this was a big problem. But now we already have a good amount of clients in order to sell everything in a good way.
And for the producers you work with, what holds them back to do this themselves? Like, why, if they already work with a local butcher to slaughter, basically, then what keeps them from selling it themselves compared to selling the animal to you? Is that much easier? Is that like the marketing piece, obviously distribution? Like what makes them wanting to work with you, apart from that you probably pay hopefully early and good prices?
Yeah, I mean, there are no large enough fields in order to scale these kind of farms. So if you want to do extensive kind of breeding in Italy, you have to keep your farm small or medium at the maximum. You cannot,
What is medium? How many animals are we talking about with medium?
In average, between 100 and 300 animals per cattle. So not a lot. And, if you want to scale it, you have to do intensive because there are not enough enough big spaces in order to put all these animals at the pasture in,
in
Italy.
Because yeah, in one group, it becomes a herd, basically. Yeah,
of course.
So they are relatively small. Yeah.
Yeah. So the local farmers in this dimension cannot build, for instance, managerial activities, cannot build a sales team, cannot organize in a very well system logistics and supply chain. They, you know, the intensive breeding have short-term return on investment because the animal life cycle is shortened. I mean, you have a ready animal maybe in 1 year and a half. In this case, maybe you need 3 years, so the double. And you cannot either do marketing and communication in a good way because, you know, you're maybe, you're probably 2 people, 3 people, 4 people at the maximum, and you don't have the know-how and the capabilities in order to vehiculate the value proposition and all the values that your farms has. And so they have very big problems about commercial activities. They sell to private people, as you said before, that they buy the entire cows and put into the refrigerator, or to local butchers. But any time it's like a bargain with the butcher. And so they raise cows, but they don't be sure to sell all the wool production. And what we do, it's of course support the breeder, pay them more compared to the market, and ensure to buy the wool production. So the breeder can think just to breed and to improve the methodologies in breeding, pasture, and so on, animal welfare. And yeah, I think this is the best way in order. So any step of the supply chain focus just on his own
specialization. Yeah. And so how has been the impact for some of the breeders? Like, how, like, you're relatively young as a company, 3 years, you mentioned 2019, like some of the oldest ones you've been working with, like, how has that changed? Has that fundamentally changed their business outcome, or like have they hired new people or gone back to the land? Like, what has been the impact of offering this sales channel, basically, or this secure, well-paid sales channel? Have you seen impact on the land, or impact in this case with the communities?
Yes, of course. They're changing, they're growing. For instance, of course, we just select breeders who already are at a very high level. But for instance, they cultivate a lot of field with conventional methodologies, and they're changing to organic methodologies. For instance, they're buying more animals. There are many abandoned fields to the pasture, mainly in the Alps, and they are recovering them. But yeah, we started in 2019 in 2 people, and me and my co-founder were both economics, you know, students, and probably we couldn't distinguish a donkey from a cow at the beginning. And so just in the last year, we built a strong team about livestock, and we are getting results now, and next year we are seeing more.
And just the impact of animals on, like, the, you mentioned there, abandoned pastures in the Alps. Like, what happens if they're abandoned? Like, why is the animal impact there? Or is the animal impact important? And if yes, why?
Yeah, there is a very big, you know, biodiversity system related to the pasture. So insect, other animals, plants, and so on. And, you know, according to WWF, we are losing around the 20% of semi-natural species. Because we are stopping doing the practice of pasture with animals. And so I think that the soil can erode, first of all. Because you know there are fields without trees, without anything. So if there are no animals who fertilize the soil and so on, there are systemic damages basically. And in other cases, simply the forest or the trees can get back and get the pasture.
And what are your plans on that side, like on the grazing? There's a lot of discussion, obviously. We had a lot of conversations here on the podcast as well. What do you see there as potential to work with these farmers that are already at a relatively high level? Like, what do you see that you can do with them over the next years to improve grazing, to start measuring soil organic matter or the impact of the animals on the land, also on biodiversity, etc.? What are your plans on the, let's say, the side effect of having animals on the land in a proper way?
Yeah, we are working with universities also, for instance, the University of Florence. And so first of all, we are trying to implement a measurement system into the fields in order to understand exactly how the amount, for instance, about organic matter into the soil or all these things. So we would like to collect data, first of all. And it's pretty obvious that you know following the nature path, as we said before, is the right choice because you have to copy and paste. But we would like also to measure the data in order to understand specifically where we are going. And you know,
How are the
first of
farmers
all,
interested in
we
that?
can.
Are they like how are they receptive when you come in, of course, to guys that don't distinguish a donkey from a cow, and you say, ah, maybe grazing could be different. Like how do they take that, or what is your strategy there to take them along, let's say, in this journey of discovering how to get more biomass, more biodiversity, more life, more healthier cows, better grass management, etc. But not wanting to be the let's say pushed off the farm as go back to the city and go do something useful.
I mean, our breeders follow us because you know they trust us because we prove that we are trustable. But we explain them also that from an economic point of view, in the long term, you know the nature path is the best one because you know in the short term, you know with chemical and so on, of course you can improve the quantity of product that you make, but in the long term, it's all about fertility of the soil. It's all about biodiversity, and I
And
think that
quality, yeah.
now and quality, of course. Nowadays, you know, sustainability it's probably a matter of it's an optional choice. In 10 years, maybe 15, 20, 30, I don't know, but it will happen. Sustainability, it will be a mandatory choice. So either these or you don't eat.
And what about the quality? Do you do? I mean, obviously, you are eating your own padding. Let's say you're one of the clients. But what do clients say? Customers say? What have you seen? Are you doing any potential research in the future on like say the nutrients compared to? And then we get to the supermarket piece, which is fascinating. But like next to the ones like imagine the supermarket in the shelf there is the Pascal aisle, and then next to it is. Let's say the factory farmed ones, etc. Like, how would you describe the difference between the two in taste, in color, in nutrients? Like, how would you describe that to someone that hasn't tasted the difference yet?
Yeah, the taste is original. I mean, you feel the meat. About properties of the meat, it really depends on the pasture, on the animal, on the zone, on the area. There are many factors that can influence this. And we, of course, make averages in order to, you know, give data in general to our customer that these data are very, very higher than the average of the conventional market about protein, about many things that are contained to the meat.
Vitamins, etc. And so how has been the response
Yeah.
from customers when they taste? I mean, how much do you get a lot of repeat I mean, you're growing as a company, so I'm imagining, yes, like people are discovering like how meat used to taste or how meat could taste, etc. What has been response from the market?
Yeah, they love, of course, the taste of the meat, but I think that our customer mainly buy Pascola because of the value proposition. So they like to spend their money in this way. They like to give money to breeders who follow this kind of methodology. They like to ensure animals a good life, basically, and all these things. So, and also in marketing and communication, we put a lot of focus in about these topics. We don't focus a lot on the product, that it's very, very good, but it's okay. We focus mainly on the, you know, side effect that your choice
And so then bring. How did you and why, and let's talk about the details there, decided to start selling in the big supermarkets, the big, I wouldn't say quote unquote enemies, but the large ones that are selling all the low quality ones as well. How did that happen? Did they reach out to you? Did you reach out to them? Why didn't you stay in, let's sell directly online, let's keep that, let's say, relationship completely with us? Why did you decide to go to the large distribution centers, the supermarkets, which are massive in Italy, by the way, just to understand, like there are a few really, really, really big ones.
Yeah, mainly in this country, the e-commerce market is not scalable at all. If you have one product, mainly because you know, people won't buy meat on one website, fish on another, vegetables on another one, and just wait maybe 2-3 days for the deliveries.
So you reach sort of a limit of what was possible.
Yeah, I think that the problem is not distribution. I think the problem is production and consumption. So we have to, first of all, I think, educate the customers, because they give money to producer in order to produce. And I mean, we have a producer and customer that should be educated, of course, and the distribution just follow the education of these groups. I mean, I don't think that the big distribution and large distribution are the root of the problem. I think it's just a consequence.
And so you started talking to them, or they started talking to you, and then what does it mean for your margins? Obviously, you keep more of it, but you have more costs if you're selling directly. How does that work in large supermarkets? Because what you don't want is become the discounted article, like the one day they get people in with, like some of the veggies are always used and some of the meat as well, to pull people into the supermarket. And then we hope you buy some brand things that have more interesting margins. Like how do you dance with such a big player that obviously is able to push or not, because they are massive compared to such a small player as you?
Yeah, we are some people in the, you know, large distribution sector, and, you know, large distribution love our product. We are not a commodity. We are not just about margin for them, but we are also about branding. So in our case, our margin is very good. And, you know, taking into consideration the deliveries that are very, very, you know, the B2C deliveries that cost a lot in this country, the margin is pretty much the same. That's a fair margin. And yeah, as I said, that the big distribution brings Pascal into their store also because the branding, because they love to associate their brand with, you know, someone who tries to, you know, bring value to the environment, to the small breeders and so on.
Do you see people then buying it in the supermarket and some of them buying it then directly from you, or they stay in the supermarket? Because as you said, it's easier to buy your fish, your veggies and everything in one place and bring it home immediately. Or is there some linkage between the B2C and the B2B?
So we will be in 220 stores by the end of June, but so far we are just in 25 supermarkets.
Okay.
So we don't have enough data in order to say that.
To say
but
too much about that.
I hope that, yeah, they will buy in the supermarkets and then online.
Yeah, but for your margins, what you mentioned, it doesn't really matter. So it's also, I mean, it's a lot less hassle, obviously, if you sell it to one supermarket chain, and then it's they do the distribution, which you mentioned a few times. You don't want to, or you don't think it needs to be reinvented. That's not where the root cause is. The root cause is our food choices and the production methods. And so, what would you say to, like, say, and for sure you're talking to them as well in Milan and other places, to the finance world, to the people looking at, and in some cases financing, the large industrial, very intensive and very extractive meat industry. Let's say we're in a theater. Let's change the setting a bit. We're in a theater. We're on stage, and this is a meat conference in Italy, and we're having this conversation there. What would you tell them? What would you tell them when they walk out of that room? What they should do, or what they should be looking, or what they should be digging a bit deeper? What would be, obviously without giving investment advice, but what would be your direction for the finance world that is involved in the meat industry to go to?
This is a very difficult question. I think the problem is rooted into the system, into our ideas and mentality. So I think that until we change that, going to the financial system or others.
Okay, but we have them. We have them in that audience. They're sitting there. So what would you tell them? Like, nature is always right, or visit this, look at, visit this and this, or look at that and that. Where would you guide them what to read or what to taste? What would you tell them to, how to influence or nudge that mentality? How can we get them to be open to think differently?
Unfortunately, I think the fastest way is just to mention, a wallet. Because, sustainability nowadays, it's also...
Okay, so what do you tell them? You tell them, like, look, it makes more sense economically?
Yeah, it makes more sense economically. You don't see this in the next 5 years, maybe, but you will see in the next 10. I mean, now sustainability, it's an optional choice and it's an investment opportunity. In when will be a mandatory choice, won't be anymore an investment opportunity. It will be, a needed opportunity. You have to do this in order to eat or to drink or to breathe, a good air and so on.
So you're saying it's the ideal moment. It's the you want to create a bit of fear of missing out, a bit of FOMO of, like, look, this is an investment opportunity now. It might take a few years, but you don't want to miss out on this wave.
Yeah, I think that fear of missing out will be a good way. We have a fear of missing out in many sectors where, it's... there is no sense in order to have FOMO, but in this sector, probably it's the FOMO is very needed.
And what would you do if we switch the conversation? You are in charge of a large investment fund, let's say a billion euros, and you can invest it anywhere with any length of time as well. So you don't need to be restricted to the traditional 7-8 year fund, etc. You can invest it however you like. What would you focus on? Is it the animal protein side, or is it maybe something completely different? The oceans. What would you focus if you are not running Pascal, but actually running this investment fund to put money to work in regeneration, in sustainability?
Yeah, first of all, investing in Pascal, and then probably just buying resources. I will buy fields. I will buy forestry. I will buy water resources and so on. And I would try to protect them and get the maximum from them at the same time respecting them. I mean, I think that we have to build a production and consumption system that are consistent with the biological systems. So I would like just to experiment in natural places how to produce and consume in a very consistent way with the natural systems.
And would you do that in Italy or in other places? Where would you focus your attention?
I think I'll differentiate it. So I will do it in different places in order to have different opportunities about contingency in general, in order to have different characteristics of soil, areas, zone, and so on.
And what would you like to experiment most with? Is it the animal integration? Is it extreme composting technology? Is it I don't know, remote sensing using satellite? What would you, if you had unlimited resources like now, what would be your first experiment to say, okay, yeah, if we would have them, like, what would we push on?
Probably agroforestry. So, you know, a place where there are at the same time trees, animals, plants, water, and so on, and try to find a balance into a system, basically. Try to find a balance with the natural things that surround you.
And then, I'm sorry we take your fund away, but we give you a magic wand where you can change one thing in the ag and food space, or in the land use space, or sea even. Of course, you can choose that. What would you change overnight if you had? Would you take out all, I don't know, antibiotics from the system, or all animals outside? We've had that answer a long time ago. Actually, somebody mentioned that. I think Iroquois Valley Farm, one of the co-founders. Like, what would you do? Or something completely different, like food traceability on all animal protein, or all food, or CO2 labels. I mean, what would you, being so deep into all the sides, actually, all the way down to the consumer, but also the big distribution and the production, if you had a magic wand, but you could only change one thing, what would you do?
I think it's a compromise choice. And I, in any case, this choice will have a lot of effect in, you know, on the system, on society, and so on. And I will go, you know, stronger on it. And I will totally exterminate the chemical products. Of course, we will have, you know, low production in the next few years, and maybe many crises, also about anger and so on. But I think that in the long run, it will have very positive effect for the ecosystem in general, stopping using chemical products on ground, water, and so on.
And what is exciting for you? I mean, you're going from 200 or from 25 to like 220 stores. And that's pretty exciting. But the rest of the year, we're talking in late spring 2022. How does the rest of the year for Pasco look like? What are big milestones or things you're looking forward to, and also maybe a bit scared about?
I mean, we would like to still adding value to any steps of the supply chain. So from the breeders, we are trying to work with institutions. So for instance, European Union, in order to find funds, in order to, you know, make the transition faster. And as I mentioned before, we would like to implement the partnership with NoFence, and maybe also Rumi. I mean, all the tools that can bring value. And then, of course, finding more clients, because, you know, more clients we have, more producer and farmers that we can value. And in the middle, we'd like to build a customized software in order to bring all the data about the supply chain together, about the transportation, about farms, livestock, pasture, and so on, and try to make a life cycle assessment of the whole supply chain in order to understand the real impact, in order, of course, to CO2 emission, but also to systemic benefit or malus to the system. So, you know, we'd like to measure the biodiversity of the environment where our farms work, the quality of the soil, the quality of the water, and so on. And we'd like to do it in blockchain, if possible.
I will definitely link it below if it's out at when this is out. We did a long interview on life cycle assessments with Mariko, which was fascinating. She's the co-author of the one that they did on white oak pastures, which I think is the first LCA on a multi-species farm, and also the first that actually did soil analysis and included the sequestration potential in life cycle assessment, which is quite scary because it means until now we never did that. And we had a long discussion on the multi-species side, but also the carbon focus, and probably a bit too much focus on carbon, and also on the emission side and what needs to happen, let's say, to make them much more robust and much stronger, because they only tell half of the story at the moment, and the other half is either based on very old models or based on data that we simply don't have. I will link below also Rumi, which is interesting to find out, obviously, more, and NoFence, virtual fencing side of things. So I think there's a lot to do. And is that, sorry, as the last question, is that the limiting factor at the moment, the amount of customers you have? Or because if you had more customers, you could easily scale up with more of your farmers, like there's more space there? Or is it also a limitation of finding the farmers? Or you say, no, that's there, we have enough space, enough animals, enough growth, easy growth, let's say.
The mainly limitation nowadays are about operation, because, you know, it's not a software, it's a real life supply chain. So
it's stuff that needs to be fresh, otherwise it decays. Yeah, it's not that you're selling almonds that are dry and you're fine, or software, like you said, you're selling something that is literally alive.
And we are, you know, working also through many geopolitical contingency, for instance, you know, the pandemic, the war, the price of raw materials went up a lot in the last 6 months, basically. So we had a very big problem about packaging, because our package is half cartoon and half plastic. And it's both recyclable, of course, but we bought around 3,000 cartoncini. How do you say cartoncini?
Boxes.
Boxes, right? And they were not working, basically. So we lost a couple of months with clients such as Coop and others, because we couldn't package the meat.
And the packaging industry, like cardboard, is very difficult to get a hold on. Yeah, no, it's not a software that you can just switch on a few servers at Amazon and you're fine. No.
And at what one time you have a lot of producer and not so many clients. Then 1 week later, you have too many clients, not so many producer. And you have to keep a balance, you know, growing. It's very, very difficult, because you have to be always in balance and at the same time growing month per month.
So is that what you enjoy? You mentioned at the beginning that I like to create things that are not there. You're smiling a lot now. You cannot see that on the, you cannot hear that in the audio. Maybe you can actually. Is that what you enjoy, or is it also uncomfortable at some point?
Yeah, I love our uncertainty. I mean, I don't like things, routine and things.
Otherwise
that,
you would have worked at a bank in Milan. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I will do something else, of course.
And so do you see with this crisis, I mean, I keep saying last question, but with these crises on pricing, etc., and prices of inputs, in many cases, I think people have seen the crazy fertilizer prices already last year, and now, of course, with the war even more. Do you see like differences in the low input farmers you work with and let's say the high input ones, like other prices getting closer to each other in the supermarkets? Do you see any of that yet? Like prices are being changed? Do you see that you have less? Because, for instance, Wild Farmed, I talked to recently, they say, we use so little inputs that we're suffering because electricity and petrol and other things and packaging, but it's not the raw, like the input prices for us. We don't have so much of that. So we're less suffering than our competitors. And maybe finally the prices of bread are getting close to each other of the low input ones. Do you see that as well, or is that too early?
I think that's a very interesting thing, because, you know, our supply chain is very self-sufficient, also in production of raw materials such as cereals. Of course, our cows are raised extensively, so the amount of cereals they eat, it's very, very small. It's like about the 20% of the total ratio of the nutrition of the cow. And all these cereals are basically homemade in the farms, no GMO free and so on. And in the conventional beef supply chain, the amount of cereals that the cows eat, it's around the 80%.
So that's four times. So we go from 20 to 80. Yeah. Just for your, like, okay, you can do the calculation. And they're not grown on the farm itself, for sure.
It's the opposite. And these supply chain are very dependent about importing cereals, for instance, from Russia, Ukraine, and so on. And in this case, you know, when there is a war and a problem about raw material in general, these prices goes up a lot. And the price of, you know, conventional meat at the supermarket went pretty much close to our meat. Wow. So you pay basically the same for a product that it's
not the
different
same. Yeah.
In
that's fascinating. Do you see that? Do you see? I mean, you're in relatively small supermarkets, but do you see now that helps, like in terms of sales and maybe also in general the whole discussion on this self-sufficiency and food sovereignty and should we import a lot of stuff? I know in many European countries it has been a big discussion on fertilizer, on grain and wheat, etc. Have you seen an uptick since the beginning of the year in terms of sales, or is it very difficult to see?
As you said, we are still in so few supermarkets. So I think we'll see it in, you know, in the next year, in the next few years. And that's the reason why I was suggesting to investors to invest in this way. Because this is an example of how, you know, a good supply chain for the system, it's also good for the wallet, for the investors. Because, you know, one of our goals is to build a totally sufficient supply chain. So without anything imported or exported outside the supply chain.
It's a very interesting
you,
focus.
You protect a lot yourself from whatever happens.
Currencies,
crises, yeah.
Communities. Yeah. You know, it's I think many people underestimate how many
madness
disease, health. I mean, there's a lot there, yeah. And I want to be conscious of your time as well and look forward to speak to you in the future and see how far you got and what kind of very interesting experiments and larger than experiments you have been implementing. So I want to thank you so much for your time, Federico, today, and good luck.
Thank you.
And thank you for what you do, and good luck with disrupting, I think it's the 9 billion euro Italian beef market, which is a bit of space to grow.
Yeah, maybe 7.5, but, you know, still so big.
Still enormous, yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you a lot. Bye. Ciao.
Thank you so much for listening all the way till the end. For the show notes and links discussed, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/post. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again and see you next time.